from 10,000 villages in downtown Champaign and Crossroads Global Handcrafts, 428 North Main in Bloomington, providing income to third world artisans by marketing their handcrafts and telling their stories in North America.
This is Focus 580, hour number two of the program. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frain, is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be giving you the opportunity to call in here and ask questions about insect pest problems. This is something that we do occasionally here on the program, particularly in the starting in the spring and going through the summertime when the insects are going to be the most active, particularly on the outside. So if you have a problem, you can pick up the telephone and give us a call and tell us all about it and get some advice here from our guest, Phil Nixon. He's an extension entomologist here at the University of Illinois and has done this program with us quite a few times over the years, advising people on how to deal with all manner of insect pest problems. Now, the way he is he, interestingly enough, often counsels people, well, now, can you live with this or not? If you can't live with it, though, and there are some times when, yes, the insect problem is serious enough so you can't live with it, you can't coexist, well, okay, we'll tell you what to do about it. 333-9455, that's the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line. That one is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And either way, whichever of those numbers works for you, if you have a problem, give us a call. Thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
Once again, things are a little, at this time of year, I suppose, a little bit quiet. Not a lot of activity yet.
They build up in the spring, and then they keep going typically, but we're in kind of a cool, damp time right now for a week or so, which means things are going to abate a little bit, but they'll build back up. But most of our things, insect-wise, the most exciting time for entomologists is May and June, so as far as more things being out. So
yeah.
So it's right in the end of a time when it's commonly coming, but it'll build up a little more than it is now.
Well, we have a couple of people here who have questions, so let's start in with Champaign. This is the first, and it's line number one. Hello.
Hi. Just about 2 days ago, all of a sudden, I had like millions of little ants running around my kitchen, and there isn't really much food sitting around or anything. Wash the dishes, and there are maybe only thousands now.
Yeah. Well, what happens with those is that generally the ant colony is next to the foundation of the house out in the soil, or if you have a crawl space, it may be in the soil in under the crawl space. And what happens is that the heat from the house will warm up that colony. You have some bleed out of your warm air from the house into the soil around the house.
Mm-hmm.
And this will warm up the colony to where you end up, it becomes active. Most insects become active at temperatures above 50 degrees Fahrenheit. And so the soil is warmed around your house. They become active, but it's not reliably warm enough outside to do a lot of foraging outdoors. And so what they will do is they'll follow that warmth in and into your house through cracks or crevices. And if you're something as small as an ant, even a relatively small crack or crevice looks like a wide open door to them, and they can feel the warm air coming out of it. And they will follow these and come up into the house, and then they'll forage for whatever they can find. Many times they will do this until it warms up enough outside that they can go outside and reliably forage. And so when we had some temperatures where the lows were in the 50s, but we're down below that now. So the ant problem should get a little bit worse here until sometime around the middle of next week when the cold below that's sitting over us leaves and we get a little bit warmer temperatures. You can expect a little more in the way of these ants. Typically, when the ants will tend to look at two different kinds of food many times. If they're trying to maintain the adults, which is what's going to have spent the winter in the colony, they will be looking for sweet things to eat, and they are attracted to sweet baits, such as taro ant bait or grant ant bait. If they have started to start brood, as we call it, have laid eggs, and the eggs have hatched in the larvae are protein feeders, and they will go after protein baits, or the so-called grease ants that people colloquially call them,
mm-hmm.
And they will go then to protein baits, such as combat ant bait. And so many times, experience that I've gotten from calls that I've been getting in the last couple of weeks is that they've already switched over to looking for protein bait. So I would imagine a combat ant bait put around in areas would get rid of your ants. Or alternatively, in about 2 weeks, as it warms up, probably your ants will leave if you do absolutely nothing at all.
So I can just wait it out.
You can wait it out if they don't really bother you that much. We've had them crawling around on our counter for about the last 3 weeks, but they haven't been enough of a problem for us to do anything about it. We know that in the next couple of weeks they're going to quit doing it anyway.
Yeah, that's been my experience in the past, that they just kind of disappear.
Yeah.
Is there anything I can put out that's less harmful to discourage them, like, I don't know, a soap film or...
You can, if you notice where they're happening to be traveling, they travel by following a scent trail that they lay down, a pheromone trail, and anything that washes that away will confuse them greatly. And you can use soapy water. Some people use ammonia, some people use bleach, but really all you need to do is soap and water in the areas where they tend to be trailing, and this will confuse them and make it such that it's at least several hours to a couple of days before they come back. But they probably will come back once they figure out where things are. I sometimes tell people that that's a good option if you're going to have people over for a luncheon or something, wash up all around those areas and clean up all the pheromone trails and wash them away. And it'll probably be several hours before the ants find their way back, and none of your guests will realize you have ants.
Suggestion. Thank you.
Right, thanks for the call. Well, let's go talk with someone in Indiana on line number 4 right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
Mine's sort of a general question that deals with what we'd call pests, but I was wondering from your knowledge of the pest insects, are using those as a marker, is Indiana and Illinois basically have the same insect population? Is there anything on the, say, you know, I can't see anything from Kentucky or anything like that, but I know you guys are closer to the, you know, you're in the prairies. And I thought there might be different insects. And the reason I'm asking is I can get a hold of a book that talks about the Illinois insects. And I presume that, you know, that would basically cover Indiana also. I just wanted to know if you would have any information on that.
In general, the insects that are pretty much the same from Ohio through Missouri.
Okay.
And so, in general, the Illinois and Indiana insects are very, very similar. We do have, there are some pests that I get much better photographs of when I visit the Purdue campus than I can find in Illinois. Sometimes Purdue people come over to Illinois and they get excited about some of the things they see here. But
yeah.
But in general, the problems tend to be the same. For several years, I could always get much better pictures of Japanese beetle damage over at Purdue campus, or some of the mite damage seemed to be worse there. But you know, in general, it tends to be very similar. They've come over here and got excited about pine sawfly, so you know it varies a little bit. But in general, all the pests are found in the areas, and the non-pest insects tend to be very, very similar. In fact, in probably most of the species that we have of insects that occur in Illinois are found all the way from probably about Atlanta, Georgia, all the way up to maybe as far north as Churchill, Canada, where the polar bears show up on the south edge of Hudson Bay. So
it's much larger.
Most of the insects have a very wide range. Mm-hmm. There are some notable exceptions to that, but pest-wise. But in general, the insect fauna tends to be relatively similar. And you could kind of a book that was from Michigan or something, and the insects would be almost identical.
Helpful. Because, those books go on sale over a period of time, and I've just, passed them by thinking there might be, some differences, not even subtle. But I'm glad to know that
Most of the insects in the Midwest are pretty much all over the Midwest.
Yeah, that's going to help me. Thanks a lot.
All right. Well, thank you. Let's go back here to a caller in Champaign, line number 2. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have a carpenter bee problem, and I'm wondering what I can do to get rid of the carpenter bees on my house.
Well, the long-term prevention is generally they will attack unfinished wood, and rarely are they going to, or less common, are they going to attack wood that has paint on it or a paintable stain, or a varnish type on it. Regular stain that soaks into the wood, that's not a paint type stain, will still go through. And so prevention normally means that usually you get these into unfinished wood and putting a putting a finish on them will normally stop that from occurring in the future. Ones that you have now, you can put a little bit of Carbaryl, which is sold as 7. You use a dust formulation, so that would be 7 dust. It is a small amount around the opening of the carpenter ant burrow. Carpenter ants will tunnel into wood and turn at a right angle and go lengthwise up the board as much as 2 feet and form a series of cells in there that they fill with pollen and lay eggs on, and the eggs hatch, larvae feed on the pollen, pupate in there, and then the adults will come out. It's important that when you do this treating around there, you're probably going to only kill the female that is doing this. And if she's already made a couple, three cells, those will come out, and there's not much you can do about that. But they're not going to cause any real damage in addition to what it is. But it's an important thing to leave that opening open that they're going in and out and not caulk it up. I've had some people that, I don't know where they're thinking or where they're coming from, but you have an insect which is tunneling through wood, and they think somehow by caulking a hole they're going to block these wood-eating insects inside and kill them. What happens then is the young bees that come out, since they can't come out the main hole, which they normally do, all one right after another, they each make their own hole, and so now the person has, instead of one hole in the wood, he may have 10 or 15 right in a row right down the board. And he calls me back up and gets up in out of shape, and I says, "Now, I didn't tell you to caulk that hole, did I?" But you can caulk it in the wintertime, but don't do it in the summertime. Right. They may come out later in the summer and make more damage than you have now.
Okay, so that was Soda 7?
It would be sold. The product is sold as 7, S-E-V-I-N, dust. It's dust formulation.
I see.
Bees are all very hairy to collect pollen, and as they come into this opening, this dry dust will collect on their hairs, the 7 dust, and this will, and then they'll groom themselves and get inside their body and will kill them.
Great. Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks. Just for a point of information, if people have seen these bees, or maybe they've seen a very large thing that looks sort of like a bumblebee, except not quite, and they're not really sure what it is, you know, how can you distinguish a carpenter bee from any other bee?
Good point. It's something that I've neglected to say, what a carpenter bee looks like. We have two kinds of carpenter bees. One is the large carpenter bee, and one's called a small carpenter bee. You can probably get a good idea what the difference is. But the large carpenter bee is about an inch long, and they're very rotund individuals. They look like bumblebees, except for their entire abdomen is all black in color. There's no yellow hairs on that abdomen, whereas a bumblebee, there will be yellow on it. The small carpenter bee is similar in size, similar in appearance, only it's only about a half an inch long. And so actually, the large carpenter bee is more like probably 3/4 of an inch long. So they will. They are commonly seen around flowers, particularly in the spring of the year. The large females are. They are very good pollinators. In fact, there are places in this country in which carpenter bees are encouraged for their pollination of alfalfa fields and some other things. Hmm. So they're actually excellent pollinators. Generally, carpenter bees you're going to see hanging around wooden areas, and bumblebees, they nest underground in an old rodent burrow or something, and so they may be going down into the soil, and they're not going to be causing any wood damage.
Yeah, I know this spring that I have seen some around my house, and clearly you can tell they're looking for some place.
Yeah, they'll be hovering around the wood if they're carpenter bees. And so that's usually a good way to tell rather than just starting to declare war on some bee you see flying around your flowers out in your yard or out in your garden or something of this nature, because they are excellent pollinators, and very likely the carpenter bees may be tunneling into a dead branch on a tree and not causing any harm to anybody in any way, and those that are out there pollinating are doing you a great service. So, you know, just worry about the ones that are attacking your wood, and don't worry about the ones you just see flying around.
All right. Phil Nixon is our guest. He's extension entomologist at University of Illinois, and every once in a while he's here. We talk about dealing with insect pests. It can be either in the house or outside in the yard and in the garden. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. The next caller is in Champaign, line 3.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I have a mystery I'd like you to solve. The bugs themselves are about twice the size of poppy seeds.
Okay.
They have a hard shell. I can't really see anything else on them. I haven't put them under a microscope. But I find them. We have two windows next to the front door, and I find them at the base of the windows, and they are dead. But every morning there's about a dozen of them. I can't see any area where they come in from. These particular windows don't open. They're just sealed windows.
Do they have any reddish tint to them, particularly their legs?
As I say, they're about...
I know they're awful small.
Yeah, I'd have to put it under a microscope.
Are these south or west windows?
They face east.
Okay. I'm guessing that probably what you're seeing are clover mites. Clover mites are going to be... They're large for mites, but they're probably about half the size of a straight pinhead, which puts them in the size or a quarter of that size. And they will come in large numbers at various times in the year from your lawn. They feed not only on clover but also on grasses, turf grasses, and particularly if a grasses of a lawn comes straight up to the outside wall. This will increase the number. They have a tendency to come in on the south and west sides, but that doesn't mean that would be the only place they would come in. But they're small enough that they'll get through cracks and crevices even on what we would call a sealed window.
Uh-huh.
They will be attracted to those areas. We normally recommend prevention of that by, if there's a problem, by having a 2 to 3 foot wide area of tilled soil next to the foundation, which provides a lot of cracks and crevices for the mice to hide in so they don't come all the way into the house. In normal day terms, a 2 to 3 foot wide band of soil would be called a flower bed, okay? Mm-hmm. And so having something like that alongside the foundation will tend to attract and hold a lot of those mice so they don't come on into the house. If you find them crawling across surfaces, you can kill them with soap and water. You can use an aerosol, flying and crawling insect spray in cracks and crevices, but generally you can prevent them. And in fact, as few as you're seeing, that may be that almost none are coming in. Most of them are probably staying outside, and they're not being much of a problem. But that's, without seeing them, that's my best guess as far as where they're located. Because when people have a problem with them, normally the surface of a windowsill moves with them. I mean, we're talking about literally tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of them. To find as few as you're finding indicates that it's probably just a few that are straying in and nothing to be concerned about.
Okay, thank you.
Uh-huh. All right. Next, we'll talk with someone in Paxton. This is line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I had just 2 quick comments, and then I'll just go ahead and ring off. I have a friend of mine, a grown man, who... was bitten by a spider. Turns out, I don't know anything about spiders, but turns out it was a brown recluse spider. And he was in the hospital for about 4 or 5 days. And I've never heard about this. And I'm guessing that it's probably attacks the nervous system. I don't know, but I was wondering what you could tell us about it, what it looks like, and why it's so dangerous. And then the other thing, I have 2 arguments that I've heard, both convincing. That if it's a wet year, that's very good for bugs because they need moisture, so on and so forth. And then I've heard, well, if it's dry year, that's even better for bugs because they can multiply if it's dry out. And I'm guessing the truth is probably somewhere in the middle and depends upon the insect. But I was wondering if you could comment on those 2 things, and I'll go ahead and listen off the air. Thanks.
All right, thank you.
I'll take the second one first. The dry year, wet year thing, if you're talking about mosquitoes, they do much better in a wet year because the larvae are aquatic, and the more you have of heavy rains, you get more of the floodwater mosquitoes developing, and so you get very large numbers of these types of insects. Various types of other insects that like moist conditions, such as fungus gnats, which will hover in large swarms that you'll see around from time to time. These are groups of males trying to attract a female to come mate with them. Their larvae will develop more in moist soils, and they will do better. Getting back to the mosquitoes, the ones that transmit diseases of the West Nile virus and St. Louis encephalitis, they like it when it's dry because they reproduce in very putrid water. And if it rains too often, the water's too fresh for them, and they don't lay as many eggs. So... But in general, for most insects, a dry year is more conducive to more insects because a major source of death in insects are fungal diseases, and fungi do much better under damp or cooler conditions. And so generally the caterpillars on the trees, the beetles feeding on trees and shrubs and plants and so on, are going to be more numerous in a dry year than in a wet year. Now, you know, associated with that is not only do the pest insects survive better, but also the insects that feed upon these pest insects, the predators and parasites. So you'll have more predation and more parasitism by other insects on a dry year because more of them survive and don't get fungal diseases as well. And so over the years, and I've been at this business coming on to 26 years, I tend to feel that it's all about the same. You can call one way or the other, but in general, we have certain pests that are more of a problem. We had more of a problem last summer when we had a dry spell in late summer due to West Nile virus, more than we've had for the 2 years before, which tended to be damp during the summer. So that had a direct relationship to that pest and that situation. But in general, I tend to think of more insects on a dry year than a wet year. Now, moving back to brown recluse spiders, the brown recluse spider is a very common spider in the southern Illinois on south. From Interstate 70 on south, the spider occurs outdoors and comes into houses. And in fact, in Missouri, it's been estimated that 70% of all buildings have brown recluse spiders in them. If you get to Florida, you would expect them to find them in 90 to 95% of all buildings, every building, okay? It is the house spider. It is a very shy, reclusive spider, as its name says, brown recluse. Comes out at night and crawls around, and if smashed, it will bite in self-defense. And the bite is poisonous in that it will cause a dieback of the skin regenerative layer and has some neurotoxic qualities to it as well. Muscular type poison in it will cause a permanent sore, a permanent opening, keeps the skin from coming over it. So you get a sore that has a scab and then sloughs the scab and rescabs over a span of several weeks and doesn't really seem to heal. There is treatment that will help prevent that and take care of that problem. The neurotoxic properties are not all that heavy, much more so in the black widow. But still, it's even in that one, it's relatively small. So it's mainly a skin problem. Now, people vary in how much they react to a spider bite as well as, say, a mosquito bite. You know, people that, or a bee sting or a wasp sting, react much more strongly than others. Similarly, not necessarily the same type of people, but in a similar way, people with different genetics will react differently to spider bites. And so some people have lost legs, have lost other limbs associated with brown recluse spider bites. But it's also felt that many people get maybe something that looks like a mosquito bite to many people from a bite of a brown recluse. Recent research in the last 6 months or so to a year indicates that many of what has been referred to as brown recluse spider bites are really staph infections caused by Staphylococcus. And if you're familiar with what's happening in the medical field right now, there are staph infections that are essentially on the incurable, and people die from them in hospitals and so on. So it is thought that probably of the bites that are reported to the Centers for Disease Control, perhaps as many as 75-80%, maybe more than that, are in fact not spider bites at all, but staph infections. So it's a very convoluted, hard thing to figure out. But a brown recluse spider, oh, by the way, it occurs outdoors from Interstate 70 on south, but occurs indoors north fairly sporadically in houses north of I-70, fairly common up through Peoria. I think it occurs throughout much of the United States on north, but other people disagree with me. But I think any time it gets into a house, it can survive in there. And you wonder, well, how do you get them? You buy other people's pests when you go buy at yard sales, or kids go to college, or you move from one part of the country to another. You take your pests with you, and these get moved around this way. The brown recluse spider is a very spindly leg spider. It usually has a leg span of about the size of a quarter. It is various shades of brown, and the only distinct marking on it is an inverted violin shape on its back, the base of the violin being at the front of the head, and the neck of a violin extending back towards the abdomen, and it's a brown pattern on that. But it's got very thin, relatively thin legs compared to most spiders, and tends to, like I said, come out at night. Control is difficult because dust insecticides are most effective, and those are best done by a professional.
All right. Well, I hope that helps. Other questions here are welcome. We're already at the midpoint. Phil Nixon is our guest. He's an extension entomologist at the U of I. We're talking about dealing with insect pests. You got a problem in the house, out in the yard, you can give us a call. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Someone next in Sydney Township, line number one, right here. Hello.
Hi. I need help on termites.
Okay.
I have two new structures, one concrete block, one poured, and they both have a aluminum termite bar on the top.
Uh-huh.
I've had them for 4 years, and I've never treated for termites. About every 2 months, I do a very thorough inspection inside and out. Should I be doing something other than that?
Well, the termite barrier, which it needs to be make sure that it stays straight out. Some people don't like because it catches on their ankles or something like this, and they mash it down, and that helps defeat the property of it. A good termite barrier is soldered or joined well together, so there are no slip joints or anything, and you may probably don't know whether there are or not.
Yeah.
But because the termites can go between those two plates where they meet. What a termite barrier does is it causes the termites, forces them to build their mud tunnels, which are anywhere from the size of a pencil to your finger in diameter, up around the outside of that termite barrier. It's not really a barrier, except it's a barrier to keep them from going up the inside of a wall where you can't see them. So that is useful from that standpoint if you realize that you can still get termites, and obviously you do because you've been looking for them. Some people get a termite barrier and a shield, and they think, well, they can't get termites then. Well, no, it just makes it obvious that you have termites. Generally, a new house is not going to get termites until they get 4 or 5 years of age, because many times it takes a while for a termite colony to find a house. Sometimes there is wood debris that has been backfilled next to the foundation, not a practice that entomologists recommend, because that rots and tends to bring termites that get anywhere near the house to the house. But if you wanted to be very careful about it, having a professional inspection anywhere from every 1 to 3 years is probably not a bad idea. But a lot of it has to do with the area. Termites are more likely to occur in an area where the soil tends to stay damp, in an area that used to be full of trees, because obviously in nature termites are a dead tree recycler. That's their job, so they're going to be more numerous in a forest. And the other thing is the farther south you are, the more likely you are to get termites. So in central Illinois, your chances are much greater than in the Chicago area, but they're still much less than southern Illinois or farther south. So, and it's all relative about as far as likelihood of getting attacked by termites.
Okay, I had a couple more questions. One, my father died some time ago, and I was, I guess, unlucky to inherit 2 1-gallon containers of chloridane.
Uh-huh.
Is it against the law for me to use those? I've been unable to find a place to take them.
Oh, you can. We just had a opportunity in the last month in Champaign Urbana. We had a pickup day.
Okay, well,
the Illinois EPA handles those, and they have on their website, there is a point where you can look up for household hazardous waste collection days, and that may be something that you can locate in an adjoining county or something of this nature, or in the coming year. It is legal for you to apply that chloridane according to its original label directions. I would not, however, even if it says you can on the label, apply it indoors, because it has been linked to cancer in laboratory animals. Probably many times I recommend to people that a fairly reasonable way to get rid of that material is to apply it as directed around the outside foundation of your house for several years until it's done. That material applied once a year around the outside of your house will essentially keep all your crickets and everything else from coming into your house. And environmentally, you're not overwhelming the soil in any one place with a huge amount at one time, and it's probably breaking down and getting rid and getting out of the environment in probably a reasonable way rather than getting stuck in some landfill that the old saying is, there are no leak-proof landfills, only ones that haven't leaked yet.
So. Yeah, I definitely don't want to take it to the dump. Are there any good chemicals that are durable and create a good bar for the insect?
Well, chlordane was the best we've ever had.
Okay.
But today, with what's available, permethrin is normally what's recommended, and it's and you'll find that in half-gallon or gallon-sized pre-mixed containers that will be say on the label. It'll say something about applying around the outside foundation and the soil next to it. You spray the foundation till it runs off, and then dampen the soil for 6 inches or so away from the foundation, and a treatment of that material will last for about a month.
Oh, so you have to do that every month.
Well, we don't recommend doing it every month. We recommend that rather you would be more proactive on the problem and remove the types of materials that insects and spiders and so on like to live in and feed on or their prey feed on, such as fallen leaves or bark mulch alongside the foundation, removing dead organic matter like that, and then caulking cracks and crevices in the foundation will help keep the insects out using a silicone-type caulk material or sealer that will move and bend as cracks move a little bit and don't get real hard. It works very well. And, of course, at the same time, you're helping your energy bill.
So if it's just purely bark mulch, not the hardwood, but just the bark, the termites will eat that?
Yes, they will eat bark. They will eat the hardwood. You can put a dictionary out there and they'll eat it.
Okay.
When people do research on termites and they're working out in natural areas, their normal bait is to put out rolls of toilet paper. So anything that has cellulose in it is bait for termites. Okay.
I see. Now, at one time, I think there was a chemical called Primus.
Premise, yes.
Premise.
Uh-huh. It's still available. It's still an excellent product. It and
Thermidor.
Are both products that are best barrier type treatments that are non-repellent to the termites, so they blunder into it. And best we can tell from tests that have been done through USDA, are probably going to last for about 10 years in protecting a structure. That's pretty good.
Okay, yeah, that's very good.
Chlordane gave us 35, but we don't have it anymore. There's no need complaining about it.
Okay, well, thank you so much for your information.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Let's go to line two. This is someone in Urbana. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have a mystery I'm hoping you can solve. We bought our house 4 years ago, and within a couple weeks, one morning we got up and there were a bunch of dead ants between the refrigerator and the wall. And we thought, oh, well, she must have treated there. But we've cleaned the floor many times in the past 4 years, and we still seem to have this Bermuda Triangle for ants between our refrigerator and our wall. And I'm just curious as to what could be causing them to come there and die.
Do the ants, what are they? What color are they? What do they look like?
They're little black ants. I don't
know
what type.
Are there any particular time of the year that they show up there?
During the warmer months, usually between, we haven't had one yet this year.
All right.
So probably during the summer mostly.
It's possible that some people, when they build a house or when they treat a house, one material that will work very well against ants as well as silverfish and cockroaches is boric acid. And it's possible that there may be boric acid within the wall there, and as they come through, they feed on it, and then they come out and die. That's a possibility of what it could be. It's not a, you know, it's got the toxicity to us, but it's not particularly that way. Another possibility would have been an application of chlordane in that area, which will last in there probably a couple, 3 years. 4 years is stretching it a little bit. So that's a possibility. And although, like I said in the previous caller, that the chlordane has been linked to cancer in laboratory animals, has not been linked to cancer in humans, and it was used. Many old houses have had chlordane applied to them, ones that are at least 30 years old. So that's not something that you necessarily need to get very real upset about. And the residue is probably breaking down pretty good by now anyway. But I would guess that my best guess is that there may be some, there's some sort of toxicant probably associated with that wall or in that, near that area. And my guess is it's likely to be boric acid.
Okay, thank you very much.
Uh-huh. All right. Let's go on to, I think, line three. We have a caller here. Hello.
Yeah, good morning.
Yes.
I got a sort of a mystery, too. I noticed that, and I've noticed this in the past, but this year seems to be more prevalent. I have a shop area out in the garage, and I noticed coming out the other day, there were, and I've noticed this before, there's like traces of what looks like black paint spots on some surfaces. And I can be gone for a day or two, and it'll appear on some things and not on others. But I'm assuming it's from some insect, but I can't quite figure out what it might be.
Is this on the outside of a building?
It's in a garage, and the doors open sometimes, so they would be coming in the garage, perhaps. It's on interior. But it looks like little black paint spots, and it's hard to remove sometimes too. I mean, that doesn't come off real easily.
How big are the spots?
Maybe a couple millimeters across.
Okay.
Very small in general, but there's sometimes large groups of them. Or it looks like either a insect or a couple have been congregating or something. And it's not necessarily dirty surfaces or anything. In fact, I have one that's it seems to be wood. Seems to be a common one, but I've seen it on metal surfaces and on like laminate covered surfaces, and just a very almost looks like tracks. But I'm assuming it's from an insect.
There's no. Is there any dead, damp organic matter underneath that area or near that area?
No.
You don't have a leak through into the wood or any sort of a water leak.
No, in fact,
there?
This would be on, like, for example, I have a stand out in the middle of a floor, and it'll be on the surface of the table. I'll see these little tracks or these little spots, and I'm just curious what that might be.
I really don't know what it would be.
Oh.
The thing that I've been running towards, and some of the listeners may see this in their own situation, is that there is a fungus called artillery fungus, which will live in mulches and so on around the side of a house or
yeah.
in damp wood. And it will forcibly eject spores, which are black, big little black spots that are almost impossible to remove. And they can shoot as high from the ground all the way up to the second floor windows on a house. And so that's where I was leading towards. Certainly things such as cockroaches and flies and so on will leave spots that will leave black spots like that, particularly flies, which tend to have liquid feces, which will dry into a black spot. But unless you've got a lot of flies that tend to come in there, I would not expect there would be enough of that it would be noticeable. So I'm a little bit confused as to what it would be.
Well, okay. Then I guess that's all questions cannot be answered. Some things remain mysteries.
Right. One mention that I also thought I should add to the previous caller about the ant question. One thing that ants will do is if they have dead individuals in the nest, they will take them out and dump them outside the colony. And what you may, in the person that had the ants between the refrigerator and the wall, it's a possibility that there are ants there that are associated with that wall somewhere. And as they have ones that die, they just take them out and dump them there. She may be looking at an ant graveyard, and that could just be from natural mortality. Bees could be ants that may be living there in that wall or associated with that wall, but are going outside primarily to forage and may not really come into the house per se to run around in the house, and she may not see them in any other way. So that's another possible explanation besides some sort of something that might be in the wall that's killing the ants and maybe getting in there. This may just be a natural dumping ground for an ant colony.
Right. We have about 10 minutes left. If there are other folks listening with questions about insect problems in the home, out in the yard, give us a call, and you can talk with our guest, Phil Nixon. He's an extension entomologist at U of I. Just for a second here, maybe we could go back to the termite question. And I'm just thinking about the fact that if one has a termite problem, there now are these two different ways you can go.
Right.
You can go with putting the insecticide in the soil with soil poisoning.
Which we call a barrier application.
The barrier method. And then there's your bait stations,
right.
which has something that within, I don't know how many years now, that's been
It's probably about 10.
A little bit more. The soil poisoning, we've been doing that for a long, long time.
Right.
The other method is a little bit more recent. There are differences in price. There are maybe some pros and cons about which one you choose. If you know that you have a termite problem and you need to do something about it, how do you think about which of those two methods you want to use?
I think it's a case of personal preference. Generally, the bait systems are more expensive because there's more labor involved. They have to put out the stations, which is probably about the same amount of labor as it is to do a treatment on the house with a barrier. But they have to come back every few months and check the stations, and that involves time and that involves money to pay these people to do so. And so generally, your initial cost that usually includes a year or so of inspections is higher than a barrier treatment. I'd say right around now, most treatments of a barrier on a typical house, if there is such a thing, is going to be somewhere around $1,700 or something, and probably a bait treatment is going to be somewhere around $2,100, $2,000, $2,200, something like that. So, one's more expensive than the other, but when you look at the total amount of money you're paying, there's not a tremendous difference there. The barrier treatment applies a lot more insecticide. You're using many, many gallons of insecticide to treat all the way around the foundation. And the bait system uses essentially no insecticide until they get the termites coming to some sort of cellulose bait, be it a slab of wood or some corrugated cardboard or some sort of a sawdust matrix. Various baits use various types of tractants. They're all pretty much the same, best I can tell. And then they replace those baits with an insecticide bait that's in a cellulose matrix of some sort right there in those little bait stations. And so even to treat the problem, you're using a lot less insecticide. A lot of people like the baits from the idea that a lot less insecticide is being used. Some people like the barriers from the idea that they're saving a few $100. The barrier treatments, if imidacloprid, which is Premis, or fipronil, which is Termidor, is used, the barrier treatments are, either of those are going to be very effective for probably about 10 years. Termite colonies can last longer than 10 years, so they can come back into your house once that drops down, breaks down. The baits have the ability to, they use insect growth regulator chemicals primarily. There are some that use slow-acting toxicants, but the whole idea on all the baits is that they're carried back to a colony, kills off a colony, or greatly weakens it to a point to where it really can't attack your house. So it can kill off a termite colony, but you can get another termite colony coming in the next spring. So just because you got rid of a colony that's attacking your house doesn't mean the next year you're not going to have a new colony attacking your house. So you've got a situation there which is not a forever answer either. And so it really comes down to what do you like, and many times I just say, you know, did one salesman and one company impress you more about being professional than the other? Because the level of control, the percentage of control may be slightly higher in a barrier treatment and a bait, but they're pretty darn similar. And none of them are perfect, and both of them are quite good. So,
All right. You
know, that's one thing people have to know if they get into termite treatment is that there is no 100% works every time termite treatment out there. And so anytime you check the Better Business Bureau on a termite applying company, they will have a thick file of complaints if they've been in the business for a while, because that doesn't work every time, and science is not to the point to where it does work every time. And when it doesn't work, people complain. So every termite company will have lots of complaints, and they also have lots of happy people too.
We have time for some other callers here. We'll get as many as we can, starting with Oakwood, line 4. Hello.
Yes. I got a question about termites also.
Uh-huh.
My neighbor lady called me the other day and says, I got them bugs coming in my house, and they're coming in between the garage and the house is attached to the garage, coming between the house wall and the inside wall. And she says, what do I got to do? She said, well, I got termites in there. Well, I said, I don't know. She was in there with a sweeper sweeping them up as they were coming in.
Well,
but she's already treated her house outside for years. I mean, it's been, they took the bait stations and put them outside, and it's been treated. And does those colonies come in every year like that?
Well, there's no, like as I mentioned, there's no 100% control treatment on termites when it works in every situation. The other thing is she needs to make sure that these are, in fact, termites. She might want to take some of those to their local extension office and get them identified to make sure that they are. The only termites that are going to come out on a floor or something like that or in an area are going to be the winged reproductives, and there are winged ants that people can confuse with those, or that may be some other totally different insect. It may not be termite at all. So the termites that do the damage to the wood, the worker termites, are white and about an eighth of an inch long, and they lose water so rapidly they never come out into the open. So you're not going to find those out on a floor. They're only going to be inside the wood. But the winged ones will come out, and that may be and even though she has a house that's treated, she may have a colony that that's very hard to get rid of in one way or another.
Well, I was wondering, maybe she already had them as in existing, already existing in the house.
Termite colonies that attack in Illinois are subterranean termites. The colony is underground, and only individuals come up to feed on the wood.
Okay.
So we're not Florida where you or Texas or various or Southern California where you can have termite colonies within the wood itself. Not in Illinois. They're going to be coming up from the soil unless you could have a termite subcolony up above the soil or a colony above the soil, but it's got to be something that stays very wet all the time, and she would have tremendous wood rot problems if she had that situation.
She had a gentleman come in here the other day and take the paneling off of one edge entrance to the wall or in one part of this tri-level house, but she had him take that panel off, and this is where those bugs were, or these flying bugs were, and that thing had been eat up on the inside with termites.
Okay. Well, I would still say that she may want to get the insects identified, and if it is termites, then she needs to work with her company that she's getting the termite treatment from, and see if they can try to do something more to rectify the problem. Many times, even with a bait situation, they will do some barrier application in an area where they know the termites might be located to try to give them a little better edge. So I would think she should explore it more, and the first step would be to make sure she's got them identified right, get some of them to an extension office.
Okay.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you much.
It sounds like in a situation like that, could that be carpenter ants?
I was thinking it could be carpenter ants. It could be, the damage from termites could be old damage. Could be carpenter ants will tend to make holes that will go crosswise of a grain, whereas termites will only eat the area between the grain of a wood, of a sapwood, the light areas between the rings, and so it tends to be more of a page-like or feathery-type look. And there will be mud in the tunnels if there's termites associated to high humidity. So, yeah, there's a variety of things that they can look at, but if she's been seeing the insects and she still has some of them, that's the easiest way to tell whether she's still got them.
All right, let's go to Effingham, line one. Hello.
Yes, one last termite question.
Okay.
And this has to do with the type of material that you put around your house. He said earlier that even whether it's mulch, any type of cellulose, they're going to eat. So what does he recommend for putting around the house besides stone? Is there any inorganic material?
Well, you can use mulch, you can use bark mulch, you can use wood mulch, you can use a variety of materials. But the important thing is not only does it need to be are termites attracted to cellulose, but are also attracted to damp cellulose, rotting cellulose. And the idea is you don't put the mulch any deeper. You want to make it shallow enough such that it does not stay constantly wet and moist. And so recommendations are that you have mulch no more than 2 to 3 inches deep, and usually more towards 2 inches deep. Most professional landscapers, that's how deep they put the mulch. Many homeowners seem to think more mulch is better, and they put something like 6 or 8 inches deep. The bottom part of that never dries out, and it rots, and it attracts termites. So we're not saying you can't use mulches, but realize that if termites are in the area, they will be attracted somewhat to it, probably not from very far away. But still, it's a good idea, rule of thumb, to not have the mulch more than 2 to 3 inches deep, so it dries out from time to time through the year.
Okay, so if it's 2 inches deep, it'll still be a weed barrier?
Yes, it will still function as a weed barrier, yes. More is not better, necessarily, in this case.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
All right. To Urbana here, line number two. Hello.
Hello. I'd like to ask a question about my garden. I have a lot of insects. First they attacked the snow peas, and then the lettuce, and now even the spinach. I've been looking to see what it could be.
What kind of damage are you seeing?
A lot of holes
okay.
and edges being kind of nipped away. Not at the base, but around the edges.
Okay. Not out in the center of the leaf, but just at the edges?
Some of them are in the center.
Okay. Damage in the center of the leaf, do you use a lot of mulching or dead organic matter? You may have a slug problem.
But I usually have seen them in the past.
Well, you might want to go out there on a very foggy morning or something like that to see if you can see them, or even at night. They will build up where you have a lot of dead organic matter, a lot of mulching and so on. And they tend to eat holes in the center of a leaf as well as eating the leaf edges around. There are also climbing cutworms that could be causing the damage that you're talking about. Not all cutworms just cut the plants off. Many of them will eat just the edges of the leaves. That could be something that you could easily find an answer if you treated with carbaryl soda 7 or rotenone if you want to go organic.
Yeah, we've always tried to be as organic as possible,
yeah.
not even using rotenone.
But that will be effective. If you want a bait for the slugs, the sluggo, which is iron phosphate, should be effective, and that's also organic. But reducing the amount of mulching will help reduce the amount of slugs and may naturally and help reduce the problem to a certain extent. You may only want to mulch part of your garden each year and maybe go a couple years between mulching in certain areas.
Thank you very much.
Uh-huh. All right. Well, that is just about it for us here for this time around. In the meantime, if people have questions, probably the best thing to do would be to contact their extension
right.
person, whoever is local to them. Like for us, that would be Sandy
right.
or that office. And
you'll find that under the white pages, the business pages, under University of Illinois Extension or underneath your county and then University of Illinois Extension. And if they don't know the answer, they have a camera system called Distance Diagnostics. They can send a picture to me or to Sandy or somebody else, or they'll refer it on to me. But many questions can be answered right there at the local level.
All right. Thank you very much.
Uh-huh. You're welcome.
Phil Nixon, he's an extension entomologist here at University of Illinois. Occasionally he's here.